Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen cannot be with us today. So that means it is my task to speak to our guest today, and our guest today is Duncan Lunan. Welcome, Duncan.
Thank you. Thanks to be here.
Now, for people who have not heard of Duncan Lunan, or for people who somehow think that name might ring a bell, let me briefly introduce Duncan to you. Duncan is a person who in the 1970s had a big bestseller. It was called, at least in the UK edition, Man and the Stars. And I will just read what it says at the back, because it actually is probably why you will remember Duncan's name from those days. We should begin to prepare ourselves now for contact with civilizations from another galaxies. In the 1920s, mysterious radio signals were picked up from a space probe circling the Earth. 50 years later, Duncan Lunan was able to interpret them as star maps originating 13,000 years ago in the galaxy Bootes, from a planet in danger of extinction. Was it an SOS from a civilization trying desperately to find a new home among the stars? This was a shattering climax to Lunan's work, confirming his belief in the existence of other intelligences in space and the need for communication with them. And then it goes on with a few more additional questions to entice the readers to read this book, which I basically think would probably have sufficed with just that introduction alone. But Duncan is so much more, and we're going to talk to him about some of the other work he has been doing since, and some of the research he is involved with now, and some of the projects in Edinburgh and Glasgow, which he is doing, because Duncan is an Edinburgh native, and as it says on his Wikipedia page, but moved to Glasgow. So, Duncan, welcome once again to the show. Just tell us a little bit about where you came from and how you began to probably put forward the most extraordinary and interesting hypothesis that definitely, I think, the 1970s or fashion statements of the 1970s notwithstanding.
Sure thing. Well, if we can begin by just correcting a couple of points, because some people listening undoubtedly will have raised their eyebrows. Bootes, of course, is not a galaxy. It's a constellation. The quotation you've read out there from the Jacket of Man and the Stars was one which I was not allowed to see before the book went to press. Publishers do insist on having things their own way in these regards, and of course, when people, when astronomers read the blurb and they saw that they'd said that, you got reviews that said Lunan doesn't even know the difference between a galaxy and a constellation. So I'm putting that one right at the outset. The other thing that has equally hung around my neck for a long time is that the thing about my being a native of Edinburgh was started by a newspaper in this country by a reporter who himself came from Edinburgh and was determined to lay claim to me. In fact, I was born in Edinburgh, but I have never lived there. I grew up on the west coast of Scotland in Troon, which any golfers listening will know. My father was himself a very keen golfer. And I was educated at Glasgow University. And one of the connections that came up in my late teens was in Glasgow, at Glasgow University Observatory. I discovered the Scottish branch of the British Interplanetary Society, as it then was, which afterwards became an independent society called ASTRA. And in the course of, I became a member at the age of 16, and there came a time when years as a student when I became the president of the society, and at that time the membership was mainly students. We were concerned, myself and the founder, the late Professor Spiegelhofer, we were concerned that when the students graduated the society might cease to exist. And to try to take it forward, I started a book project involving various distinguished members of the society, including Professor Archie Roy of the Astronomy Department and the late Professor Nonwheeler of Aeronautics, and the artist Ed Buckley, with whom I did a lot of the preliminary work. And another of the participants was the late John McRae, very keen amateur astronomer and author on spaceflight. And when we, in the discussions that we set up with the aim of producing the book that became Man and the Stars, the original idea was to discuss interstellar colonization, setting up human settlements on Earth-like planets of other stars, because nobody had written a book about that before. We did subsequently go on to looking at direct meeting with extraterrestrial intelligences. And one of the main reasons for this was that it was begun by John McVeigh. It was John McVeigh who drew attention to the idea put forward by Professor Ron Bracewell at Stanford University that a probe from another civilization might have tried to contact us in the 1920s using what was taken there at that time to be a natural phenomenon called long-delayed radio echoes. Now, I followed up the references to that, and I had actually written the thing up saying that it looked like a natural phenomenon, but there was something bugging me about it. And what it was that what was described by the researchers in the 20s was that they were hearing radio signals, either their own or from other stations, echoing, as they put it, but very loudly and very clearly, and with a delay time of several seconds. Initially, 3 seconds, the distance from here to the orbit of the moon. And the a chap called James Strong of the British Interplanetary Society had suggested that if Bracewell was right, and this was a probe from another civilization trying to attract attention by broadcasting our own signals back to us, that it might be located in the orbit of the moon at either one or other of the Lagrange points, which are equidistant from the Earth and the moon, which would be a stable orbit for a spacecraft to hold. So, putting all of this together, I suddenly realized that the key thing was that the intensity of the echoes was not varying with the length of the delay, and that indicated that the echoes were indeed all coming back from a single source, presumably a single object. And that took me back to Bracewell's original papers, and I looked again at what he'd been saying. And he had suggested that if we recognized the long-delayed echo effect as coming from a probe from another civilization, and we replied to it, we could very probably go to television messages, and should we be surprised if it began with the image of a constellation? And the thought that occurred to me was, the stars are spaced at random in the sky, and if the probe had sent us a set of star map coordinates, it would look like random variations in the delay time of the echoes, quote echoes, because they weren't true echoes. So I drew a graph of it, and I tried it 2 or 3 different ways of the message that had first been reported, assuming it was a message. And to my astonishment, I found myself looking at what appeared to be a map of the constellation Bootes with one of the stars picked out. And the star concerned, Epsilon Bootes, was an orange giant star, a dying star. And immediately I thought, we know what's motivating these people. Their civilization is going to be destroyed. They need to find a new home. And the first astonishing thing is they can send us a message by means of an unmanned probe, which we can understand, which means that not only are we not alone, but logic is universal. But in addition, they are telling us their problem. They're looking for help. And they're throwing away any advantage over us they might have right in the very first message. We are dealing here with moral beings. And, you know, these are people that we really, they're like us. We can understand them and communicate with them. And it was tremendously exciting. I've never really got over the shock, in spite of everything that happened afterwards. But, of course, afterwards things did take a different turn, and I think you were wanting to ask me about that.
Absolutely, because you had decoded the message, you wrote a book, so to speak, it got an audience, it got massive attention. You were interviewed, I think, by everybody, including American, you know, leading television channels. So then the next question is kind of like, why isn't this part of everybody's awareness? What happened next?
Well, the first major thing was that I felt that before putting this forward, I would have to try to decode all of the signals if I could. And I spent months working on that until I felt I had a package of material, which I submitted for publication to the British Interplanetary Society. And the late A.T. Lawton, Tony Lawton, who was originally in favour of it, refereed it and said, yes, we should publish this. And he was, in fact, very excited about it at the beginning. And then he went right off the idea. He was going to conduct a search for the probe, and was given equipment, basically the constituents of two satellite tracking stations by his employers, EMI, to do it. And he didn't do it. And the reason that he didn't do it was that he'd tracked down some other records from the 1920s, which didn't match with the ones that had been published at the time. And he had come to the conclusion that it was, after all, a natural phenomenon. And he simply dropped his support for my work altogether. And other things were going wrong. There was a serious problem about the characteristics of the star. Not with the major sun, but with the minor sun. It's a double star. The minor sun was coloured blue. And that was a little bit odd. According to the catalogues, Epsilon Bootis was 103 light years away. And working through, trying to translate the other messages, I thought that I had got the dimensions of their planetary system. And from that, I'd been able to work out what was going on, which planet they had evolved on, which planet they had moved to, where conditions were suitable then and where conditions were suitable now. And it all seemed to tie together, except for this problem about the blue minor sun. And Lawton and I actually drafted a paper suggesting that the colour of the minor sun had been in some way artificially changed to make a beacon to confirm the message, if you will, to indicate that there was intelligent life there. And then, as I say, he suddenly dropped the whole thing and refused to allow me to publish that paper. And it turned out that he had been in touch with Yale University, who'd done a recent survey on stellar distances, and discovered that the 103 light years was a mistake, and the true distance of the star was 203 light years. Now, that wrecked my translation of the other signals. It also wrecked the possibility that intelligent life could have evolved on a planet orbiting Epsilon Bootis. At that distance, redoing the calculations, the star comes out too massive and too short-lived for intelligent life to have evolved there. Various people have said, of course, the first half of your book is about interstellar colonization. Maybe somebody went there and settled there, and that, you know, might, in theory, be possible. But it puts a much bigger stretch on the credibility of the whole thing. And one way and another, I felt that the odds were all stacking up against it. It was becoming harder and harder to believe that it was true. And in the end, I said, OK, I give in. And I published a retraction of my original paper. I had great difficulty getting it accepted because people didn't, for their own reasons, one way or another, didn't want me to give up on it. But eventually I got that published in the Journal of the Society of Electronic Radio Technicians. And at that stage, I thought that was going to be the end of it, but it wasn't. And I suspect that's going to be your next question.
Well, all good things come in three, so what's step three?
Well, when Man and the Stars came out, one of the things that I had done in the book was an evaluation of whether the question, have we been visited? Has anyone from any other civilization come to Earth? And the approach which I took to this was a bit radical. I took the books, the bestsellers of the time, by Erich von Däniken and Peter Colosimo and other writers of that ilk, the late John Saunders and others, and I went through them all, and I listed everything that they had suggested might be evidence for contact. Then I went to the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I looked up where all these places were and what historical periods the alleged evidence related to. And then I went from there to original sources. And it was a quite fascinating exercise in its own right. It was like an odyssey through the cultural history of mankind. And when I'd done it all, I ended up with the supposed evidence organized into 20. It ended up in 22 categories, 8 of which I ruled out. And the remaining indications were two isolated events and two groups. And so at the end of the chapter, I said, on the basis of anything that anyone has put forward to date that I know of, you cannot suggest that the Earth has been visited more than 4 times. And so the book came out. And I was contacted then, independently, by two people. One was an investigative journalist in Australia called Danny Varney, who had some very imaginative ideas to suggest in this area. And the other, initially in secret, was a serving officer in British military intelligence called Alan Evans, who made it very clear to me that this was a private interest of his and not in any way connected with his work, but it would be the finish of his career if it came out that he was doing this, so initially we had to keep it all secret. But some years later, for health reasons, he had to leave the army, so it's not a secret now. At any rate, what Alan Evans particularly suggested to me was, he said, I really like the approach you've taken here, and I think we can take it a lot further. Let us set ourselves the task of finding proof that the Earth has been visited, if it has been visited. And as I said, Danny Varney was coming up with very much the same kind of idea. And the three of us, through the 1970s and into the 1980s, kept up a very active correspondence on all of this. And one of the funny things in it was that Epsilon Botis kept coming up again. References to the constellation and references even to the star, as if there was something really significant about it. But the big one that we focused in on was that Alan Evans has a quite extraordinary grasp of spatial relationships, and he was coming up with information particularly about Stonehenge and the pyramids. We were focusing in on them. And he was suggesting that parts of the orientation of these sites were laid out in galactic coordinates, which would be quite extraordinary if true, because essentially you can't determine true galactic coordinates without radio astronomy. And the other aspect of it is, it's the one coordinate system which we would have in common with people who came here from a planetary system of another star. So you would use it for navigation. And if we were finding indications that at one or two sites built by human beings, and no doubt planned by human beings, but incorporated into them, were these galactic alignments, that would be circumstantial evidence for visit by extraterrestrials, but it would be very good circumstantial evidence. However, the possibility remained, once we'd found this, the possibility remained that there was something in the sky that just happened to line up in the same way, and that what we thought we were looking at, where we thought we were looking at galactic coordinates, it was some other astronomical alignment. And it turned out to be Epsilon Bootis. So it really doesn't look like coincidence at all. It looks as if Epsilon Bootis was, as it were, an optical marker that was used, particularly in the layout of the original Stonehenge, Stonehenge 1, back around 2900 BC. And it looks as if it was built around something that had a galactic orientation. And the fact that Epsilon Bootis was the, as it seemed, the optical marker for this, really puts the whole Bracewell hypothesis of the probe and the long delayed echoes back on the drawing board, which was a very big surprise when I discovered that it wasn't something I was looking for. I'd made up a list of stars to check to see if any of them could be an optical marker in this way, and I'd put in Epsilon Bootis just for devilment, really. And when it came up as being the marker, that was a jaw dropper, because it did suggest that indeed there was something to the 1920s events and Bracewell's idea after all.
Which kind of makes me ask you for a gut feeling. What is your opinion? 30 years, almost 40 years after that initial research on Bootis, do you think there is something out there? Have other people tried to look at it? Is this something you're pursuing yourself, or where do we stand? And what's your gut feeling about it?
Well, the gut feeling is, I think we're on the right trail. Alan Evans and I brought it down at one stage to saying, we have only been visited once, and that was it. And what this comes down to, I was the only amateur scientist ever to address one of a very prestigious series of conferences in the UK called the IBM Heathrow Conferences. And this was one of the points I made in that particular presentation, that Enrico Fermi's question, the Fermi paradox, where is everybody? Why are we not already part of the galactic civilization? The answer most often given is the zoo hypothesis, or as my friend Martin Fogg calls it, the interdict hypothesis, that they are aware of us and they are leaving us alone. While we work out our own development. But if that is the case, then we must have been assessed. And to have been assessed, to me, means we have almost certainly been visited. But the next logical step in my mind, is once we are capable of formulating the question, have we been visited and assessed, I can see no purpose in denying us the answer. Therefore, I would expect to find clues of some kind in the historical record saying, yes, we have been visited, if this is true. And I think we are on the trail. I think we've got good circumstantial evidence here, and the fact that it's with the galactic alignments, and the fact that it's tying in with the previous inquiry about the Bracewell probe and Epsilon Boetus, that strengthens my feeling that we're on the right track. As to what's happening at the moment, has anybody looked? Well, Robert Freitas, very distinguished observer, did conduct a search in the late 1970s, two searches of the Lagrange points, and didn't find anything, which may or may not be decisive in this area, because there is a suggestion, although I can't for the life of me understand why this would happen, but there is a suggestion that the long delayed echo effect ceased to occur on any reliable basis round about the time that I published. It was as if, having attracted attention, the probe moved away. Why it would do that, I cannot explain. It doesn't make any sense to me. But it would explain why Freitas, 5 years later, saw nothing when he looked. I'm not aware of any other practical investigation that has been made. And while there are lines of inquiry that Alan and Danny and I are still pursuing, we haven't at the moment got anything for publication. That's where it stands at the moment.
So going slightly back to your 22 points, when you were going through the available literature, you came up with 22 items which you felt stood out. Some of these include things like what has been relabeled the Chinese Roswell, the story about how the Dzogchen tribe, or some call it the Dzogchen tribe in China, might have been the descendants of a spacecraft which crash-landed there several thousands years ago. You mentioned the Baalbek platform. You mentioned the pyramids.
Incidentally, after the book came out, I was contacted by a chap called Gordon Creighton, who had investigated that one in detail, and he sent me a copy of his paper, and he resoundingly disproves it. That particular one is a hoax.
So, yeah. when we're looking at those 22, which one of those would you say is the one which has the best possibility of being that one contact which you discussed earlier?
I think we are looking at 2900 to 2500 BC. I think it's probably a single ship. And I think it might have made two landings, one at Stonehenge and one at Giza. This is entirely my own interpretation of what we've got. I do not have proof for it. It's conjectural in the extreme, but I think that's what we're looking at.
But it is a conclusion which you draw after looking at these things for more than 40 years, so it's not just... what I will say, the conclusions of a novice. It's somebody who has been looking at this material for several decades.
That's right. And I was going to go on to say that we have now expanded the list. Having boiled it right down to one instance, we are now looking at possibly three again. Huge elements of conjecture come in here.
So what is it about Stonehenge and the Great Pyramid? Probably the Great Pyramid, people will be more quickly saying, okay, of course, that's part and parcel of the ancient alien question. But what specifically, nevertheless, about the Great Pyramid, but more specifically about Stonehenge, do you feel is a telltale indication that something otherworldly has gone on in its construction?
Well, what it began with was that Alan Evans, who, being still in the army at that point, had obtained some classified high-resolution photographs of, from the air, of Stonehenge in stereo. They have been published since. They're in Gerald Hawking's book, not Stonehenge Decoded, the subsequent one. Name of it escapes me. I'll look it up for you in a second. But they're in that particular book. They're no longer secret, but they were at the time that he obtained them. They were classified. They're very, very high resolution pictures, and in them, very prominently, and particularly in this, when you look at them through a stereo comparator, very strongly there stands out on the northwest quadrant of Stonehenge a horseshoe shaped marking. And this appears to be contemporary with the ditch and the bank, which are the very earliest features at Stonehenge, but also significantly oriented towards the station stones, the four stones which are thought to be the lunar alignments at Stonehenge, which were put into Stonehenge almost immediately after the ditch and the bank. So the thing is that the horseshoe marking does not point through the centre of Stonehenge. It grazes the what people think of as Stonehenge, the great Sarsen Circle, which constitutes Stonehenge 3 and was built many hundreds of years later. But it does, Alan suggested, mark the rising point of the galactic centre. And when he suggested this, and I did the calculation, it was still thought that the origins of Stonehenge lay around about 2000 BC, 1800 thereabouts. I didn't find any connection with galactic alignments at that stage. But almost immediately afterwards, as it happened, Archie Roy, whom I mentioned before, who's very much into the field of archaeoastronomy, published an article in the Glasgow Herald on the significance of the revised radiocarbon dates for Stonehenge, which put its origins back to 2700 BC or even a couple of centuries earlier. And when I redid the calculations, it did point to the rising of the galactic centre. And when I calculated where the galactic pole was, it was passing directly overhead at the same time. So the positions of the stars in the sky at that moment would all of the altitudes and azimuths measured from the bearing of the horseshoe would be equal to the galactic coordinates of those objects. And as I said, it then turned out that the optical marker for it was Epsilon Bootis, which is even more extraordinary. But it would have been... There was another galactic alignment as well, tangential to the horseshoe, which marked the intersection of the galactic equator with the ecliptic, one of the two intersections. And again, you're dealing with something which you can't see. For it to be built into the structure of Stonehenge is either an indication that there was something else there, or it is an extraordinary coincidence. But we're no longer dealing with a coincidence. We've now got three extraordinary coincidences, four if you count Epsilon Bootis, all at the same site at the same time. So Alan then decided to pursue the ecliptic link further, and he realized, extraordinary though it seems, that the ecliptic meridian passing through Stonehenge meets the equator at the prime meridian of the Giza pyramids, which is also the prime meridian of the Step pyramid, the first of the Egyptian pyramids. So we looked at the Step pyramid and the Great Pyramid to see if we could find galactic alignments. And we found the same two galactic alignments. that are expressed in the structure of Stonehenge are also expressed, one in the structure of the Step Pyramid and the other in the structure of this, of the Great Pyramid. So you are now up to six extraordinary coincidences. And if you're multiplying the odds over and over, you're up to odds against this being mere coincidence. You're getting into odds of millions or tens of millions to one. It is very, very remarkable. And, to quote one of my favourite 12th century historians, let each man say of this what he will, but it does not grieve me to have set it forward and publish it.
Absolutely. So here we are. We are basically saying that man and the stars, that we might have incorporated some extraterrestrial knowledge, some extraterrestrial information, if you want, in some of our monuments, and basically that the gut feeling, but also the statistical evidence, stacks up not against being coincidence, but about basically the likelihood that we have been contacted. And to somewhat change tacks, what Duncan Lunan does next is he begins to build his own Stonehenge, or tries to build his own Stonehenge on the outskirts of Glasgow, which I find an extraordinary endeavour, because actually what you were trying to do and what you are trying to do is actually something which hasn't been accomplished in Britain for basically three millennia.
So I understand. The link is, once again, Professor Archie Roy. Dr. Roy, as he still was at that time, he was then the senior lecturer in astronomy at Glasgow University. What happened was, the Labour government of the day set up a programme called Jobs Creation, which was... To go into the political background to it would take far too long, but essentially it was a piece of window dressing to try to show that revenues from North Sea oil were being put back into, particularly into Scotland. But it was hedged around with all kinds of conditions, which meant that only temporary projects could be financed. And they had to be non-profit, and they had to be non-unionised, and a great deal more of the same. What they forgot in the case of the city of Glasgow is that Glasgow has more parks per head of population than in any other city, and certainly in the UK, I believe in Europe. And the Parks Department qualified on all these counts to spend the money. So they suddenly found themselves with a budget of £4 million and embarked on a big programme of urban renewal with regard to parks and walkways and old people's gardens and all kinds of very, very worthwhile things. But they also had to have, as another condition of them getting the money, they had to have special projects. And they brought in a chap from Northern Ireland called Ken Naylor, who was very good at this kind of thing, very imaginative. And he set up a number of special projects in a hurry, because he had only two or three months in which to get all of this arranged. And one of his ideas was astronomy. And he knew nothing about astronomy. So he held a schools competition. And the winning entry was a proposal by a school kid to build a copy in modern materials of either Stonehenge or Callanish, the great Scottish site, in one of the city's parks. They approached Archie Roy with this to see if he would be the director. And he said, "Oh, I'm far too busy to take that on, but I know somebody who might be crazy enough to do it." And so I found myself being interviewed. And in fact, the pressures of time were such that at the point when I said I would do it, I was told that I had already started work, because they'd had to put down that I had done even before I said yes. But I then spent the next month convincing the Parks Department and the Manpower Services Commission that a copy of an ancient site would not work it would be on the wrong latitude. The tilt of the Earth's axis has changed since Neolithic times by about half a degree. And anyway, it has to fit into the skyline to give you the sight lines on which people can actually see things happen. So what I would have to do would be find a site and design a site for it according to the ancient principles. And I had studied archaeoastronomy under Archie Roy and his colleagues in the early 60s, so I was confident enough that I could do that. And at Archie's urging, I made the acquaintance at this point of the late Alexander Thom, the father of this field, really. A most extraordinary a genius in his way, but a most extraordinarily forceful personality. Fortunately, he quite liked me, and we managed to get on with it. But what I did was I found the location. I designed a monument to go into that location according to the ancient principles, such that the midsummer sun would rise over one of the stones at a point on the skyline where people could see it, and so on, with the solar and lunar alignments, and I put in a star alignment as well to give it a date. And away we went. I formed initially a small team, and the following year it was enlarged because we started to do a lot of work with schools and other aspects of astronomy education as well. But ultimately we built the circle. The big stones were put into position using earth-moving equipment, and then the sun stones and the star stones and finally the central stone were brought in by Royal Navy helicopter with the Glasgow schools given the day off, and thousands of cheering children surrounding the site. Much to the delight of Professor Thom, he wouldn't admit it to me, but he said it in the hearing of others. And so there it was, ready for the final stages of completion, at the point when Mrs. Thatcher was elected in 1979. And within days, I was informed that she had, either she or Sir Keith Joseph on her behalf, had denounced the project in the House of Commons. And I was told that all work was to stop. And the upshot is that the circle has never been completed to this day. And there are four unused stones still lying under a tree nearby. And there is nothing on the site to tell you what it is, how it works, who built it, or to whom it's dedicated. And all of this I would like to get sorted. In the last 10 years, twice money has been allocated to do it by the City Council, and then it's fallen through for one reason or another. But I remarried last year, and my wife Linda has started a project to get this done, which has attracted a lot of interest. And at the moment, we're actively seeking funding to do it. We have the backing of what used to be the Parks Department and is now Land and Environment Services. The work has been costed. Everything is in place except the money. So this is something at the moment I'm actively pursuing, and there is even a possibility that I might get another book out of it. I'm in negotiation with a big publisher about this at the moment.
And if anybody our listeners is interested in this, please contact us and we will put you in contact with Duncan to discuss further. Just as a side note...
Please do. I'd be delighted.
Absolutely. And just as a side note, you have mentioned Archie Roy a number of times, and I actually want to point out something which isn't necessarily to do with Archie Roy, the archaeoastronomer, but Archie has written, which I think is one of the top 10 books basically in the esoteric field, and it's called The Eager Dads. It is also one of the thickest books ever written, but it really is about the Cross Correspondences, which is a group of people pretty much from everywhere in the world, leading psychiatrists, leading alternative researchers, around 1900, who decided that when they died, they were going to do their utmost to contact the living, and thus provide proof for life after death. And it is an extraordinary scientific, spiritual, otherworldly experiment which these people concocted. And Archie has written a book, which is again called The Eager Dead, which details this in extraordinary detail, and also the breadth and scope of it, which is basically it's a riveting book, and if anybody ever doubts the existence of life after death, they should read this book. So I don't know whether you want to comment.
He's a distinguished figure in that field too. He founded the Scottish Society for Psychical Research, and in his retirement, it's something he's given a lot of time to. And yes, I agree. His books are certainly well worth reading.
Absolutely. Now, we have, unfortunately, only about 10 minutes left, but there is one topic which I want to go into, and it brings us back to where we were starting off earlier, which is this idea that we have been contacted, and you have been looking into a story called The Green Children of Woolpit, which is a very extraordinary story. So before any other questions really are going to be asked about this, can you explain to us a little bit about what The Green Children of Woolpit are?
Yes, now this is something I came across when I was a student in the astronomy section of a book published in the early 17th century called The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton. It's a medical textbook, but being a Renaissance man, he includes as what he calls digressions, everything he knows about everything. And the middle section of the whole massive work is the one on astronomy and meteorology. And the middle, right at the middle of that, at the midpoint of the whole book, though when I checked up on it, you get this throwaway reference where he's talking about the plurality of worlds and how exciting it is that Kepler and Galileo have shown that Mars and Venus are worlds like the Earth. And it may be that those green children that fell from the sky that Nubrigensis writes of in his time came from thence. Well, the footnotes tell you that Nubrigensis was William of Nubra, who is regarded as one of the more reliable 12th century historians, particularly because he saw himself as a ghostbuster. He sets out quite deliberately in his chronicle to demolish wonderful stories and supernatural events because he thinks there are far too many of them. And this particular one bothers him a great deal because he can't see the purpose of the miracle, and yet he is convinced that from the quality of the witnesses he's interviewed that this really happened. And the story is that two very strange children came out of an ancient earthwork even then in the 12th century near the village of Woolpit in East Anglia, and they spoke a language nobody recognized, wore clothing of a color and material never seen before, and were colored green all over. Initially, they were quite roughly treated, and they were put on public exhibition. But then common sense prevailed, and here we shift to another chronicle by Ralph of Coggeshall, the Abbot of Coggeshall, who knew personally the knight to whom the children were taken, a man called Richard de Calner. And knowing your time's a bit limited, cutting out the details, the essence of it was that when they had been taught to speak, be it English or Norman French, we're not clear, the account they gave of their origin was that they had grown up in a human settlement on a planet which is not Earth. It's a planet with a trapped rotation, keeping one side always towards its sun. And Burton knew you couldn't find those conditions on Earth, which is why he put it in his astronomy section. So you can see from what I've already said about the background to Man and the Stars why I thought this was worth checking up on. So I did eventually go to Woolpit and start digging around for information, looking to write an article, as I then thought. But I had gone armed with a list of questions to ask, which a historian friend of mine had given me. And people kept directing me to the County Records Office, where I discovered, to my astonishment, that the answers could be found, or at least to start me on a trail of inquiry. To cut a long story short, it appears that this incident really happened. It was expected. King Henry II had already annexed the village from the church, refused two direct commands from the Pope to give it back, and put the Vice-Chancellor of England in charge of it, although it was only a village of 60 people and worth £10 a year. And Richard de Calne, to whom the children were taken, who lived nearby, was apparently, in effect, the head of Henry's Secret Service, a very influential person, but very hard to trace. And, however, continuing with it, I believe I have traced the girl in the historical record, and I've traced some of her descendants down to the present day. And what it all comes down to is that whatever this was, this incident with the children, was the tip of a much bigger iceberg, something that the king knew about, his most trusted advisors and helpers knew about. The Pope had at least some idea about. And it's a human settlement on another world with some kind of matter-transmitter linkage to Earth. That's what the story tells you. I mean, I can scarcely believe what I'm looking at, but essentially this is the X-Files in the 12th century.
Well, it seems to be taken straight out of the Michael Crichton novel timeline as well. Okay, we have to continue with more questions on this, and I don't know where to start. First of all, what do you think was going on here? Is this something, when you say that the church foresaw this, that the king foresaw this, was it some kind of experiment? Was there a bigger picture whereby all of this was foretold, or what was going on?
Well, what it looks like, and as I say, I can scarcely believe what it looks like, but what it looks like is mass abductions by extraterrestrials for their own experimental purposes, with the knowledge, if not the active connivance, of at least some of the authorities of the day. It's the X-Files in the 12th century. That's what I've got. The book is in negotiation with publishers at the moment. The obvious question is, does it tie in with the other matters that we've discussed in this program? The bombshell is, yes, it does, but I'm not going to tell you how. That will have to wait for a while.
Well, I'm hoping that this book of yours is sold to a publisher tomorrow, and that as a result we can have you on as soon as we can have that book published, because this is probably one of the more extraordinary stories of mankind, and that features into the first part of this interview, which is probably detailing one of the most extraordinary stories of mankind as well, the story that we are not alone, but also that this isn't just a story which somehow might have happened in a very distant past and we are left to maybe look at some clues, but actually that it continues maybe to this very day, because you, as you say, you have tracked down some of these descendants. So the truth is not just out there, the truth seems to be touchable and within reach, and hopefully within the pages of your book, which is going to come out as soon as possible. So
the extraordinary thing about it looking at these three topics is that you've got three completely different fields of inquiry. You've got a mysterious radio phenomenon of the 1920s with the possibility that a message can be extracted from it. You've got the positional astronomy of Stonehenge and two of the pyramids appearing to tie in with interstellar navigation. And you've got this very human story about two lost children and some very powerful people who were interested in them. The three of them come out to be facets of the one inquiry, which, going back to what we said earlier, really does suggest that we're on the right track and that there is something there to find.
With that, unfortunately, we have come to the end of our show. Duncan, I hope you will be with us at some point in the future to talk more about these fascinating subjects. There's so much more to talk about apart from these three subjects, so we will definitely have you on again. For people who have listened to this but want to hear it again, we have archives. We have archives on the BBS Radio Archives, which is on bbsradio.com. We have archives on iTunes. For that, you need to go to iTunes and search for The Spirit Revolution. You will find not only this interview, but also more than a year worth of interview. You can also go to our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com, where you will find this interview and the last five interviews which have aired previously. So, this was Duncan Lunan. His book originally was Man and the Stars, but there is going to be far more, and we're looking forward to his upcoming book about the Green Children of Woolpit. Until next time, Kathleen would say, the truth against the world. Until next week, from the two of us, bye-bye.